Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
moving. Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and during the show we'll be joined by our 250-game veteran of the Victorian Premier League and former Notts County man Dean Hennessy and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson. And yes, for regular listeners, you'll be aware it is the week to celebrate our 300th show, and Box to Box will be total football this week as we look back over the past 6 years. But of course we're going to cover all of the important stories in football over the past week, and what better way to start than to reflect on the passing of a man thought by many as the game's greatest striker, the maestro of the Mannschaft, Gerd Müller, with Chris Williams from the Gegenpress Bundesliga podcast. We'll then talk to Sydney FC skipper and president of the PFA, Alex Wilkinson, to get a sense of the landscape of football from a player's point of view ahead of the A-League season, which is in October, but those months, those weeks will just tick by, and we'll wrap up the hour talking with New Perth Glory signing Brandon O'Neill as he returns to the club where he debuted. The midfielder had stints at Sydney FC, at Pohang Steelers and Buriram United, but he's back at the Glory. We'll wrap up the hour with that chat with Brandon, and then in the second hour, Willem will kick us off with second edition news. We'll get stuck into the Premier League after a brilliant opening round with our mate from The Athletic, Rob Tanner, who better to celebrate 300 episodes with than Rob, who's been with us all the way. Derek and Dino will dive right into all the other stories out of the Premier League and the Championship and other stories around Europe, and we'll wrap it up with some of our favourite memories of the past 300 shows. Edge, it only seems like yesterday that we were sitting in the boardroom at Media House there in the Docklands in Melbourne planning for the show, and here we are 300 episodes later.
Who would have thought, Rob? Happy birthday, Rob. Happy 300th episode. And to our listeners right around Australia and all over the world, but predominantly right around Australia, we hope you've enjoyed the 300 shows as much as we have. And another big week in football, Rob. I'm looking forward to hearing all the news and making some comments. So, Willem, what do you got off the top?
Great to be with you for another episode, guys. Congratulations on the 300. The football world, though, is mourning the loss of a titan, with Bayern Munich and West Germany legend Gerd Müller passing away aged 75. Müller joined Bayern in 1964 and scored 566 goals in 607 games for the club. For West Germany, he scored 68 in 62. He won the Ballon d'Or in 1970 after scoring 10 goals at that year's World Cup, and in 74 netted the winner as West Germany won the tournament on home soil. Plenty of other records to go through. He still leads the Bundesliga for the most goals with 365. He scored 40 in the 1973-74 Bundesliga season, a record which stood for 49 years. And he scored twice in the final of the 1972 Euros. 85 goals he scored in that calendar year. Michael, a remarkable player. The numbers speak for themselves. Unfortunately, another of that era who suffered Alzheimer's in his later years.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a few passings this past 12 months, haven't we, Willem? None bigger than Diego Maradona. But this guy, Gerd Müller, is absolutely a titan of German football and arguably probably the most important player in the history of Der Mannschaft. He was only a diminutive sort of character, 176 centimetres tall, not a large guy. He was a bit tubby too, which I quite like. Good to see a tubby bloke doing so well. But Franz Beckenbauer, I think he sums it up, doesn't he, when he says he was the most important player in the history of Bayern. He scored all the goals for us, and goals are the most important thing in soccer. So we will pay tribute to Gerd Müller. I can't wait to talk to Chris Williams in the next episode as we sort of delve into Gerd Müller, his legacy in German football, and he sadly passed away at the age of 75 years.
And Willem and Edge, if there's one stat of all the stats we've heard this week about Gerd Müller that really stands out for me, it's the comparison between him and the current record goal-scoring striker for Die Mannschaft, Miroslav Klose. So it took Klose 137 games to score his 71 goals. It took Müller just 68 games to set the record at 62. So I think that's a fair indication of the potency of the player that he was.
The Socceroos look likely to play their home World Cup qualifier against China on September the 2nd in Doha, while their following clash will be played behind closed doors in Vietnam. The Vietnam Football Association had hoped of holding 30% capacity, but average daily infection numbers of over 8,000 at the moment, unfortunately, have rendered this impossible. Meanwhile, James Johnson has criticised the federal government for turning down what he called the most complex bio-bubble football has seen regarding plans for the China game. Rob, a serious issue that we've seen coming for some time, we're now living it. We've still got Oman and Saudi Arabia scheduled to visit Australia before the year's out. It's got to be highly doubtful that those will be getting off the ground. And it's not an apples and oranges comparison. We know these sort of relationships with the government are quite complex, but you can be certain they'll manage to get the English cricket side here in November for their tour, and they'll be going right across the country. So the lack of flexibility for just a fly-in, fly-out, one-match effort is pretty disappointing, in my opinion.
Oh, look, it is, particularly off the back of the Olympics, but we know it's all about the optics. It's the politics of the situation. The Tokyo Olympics was pulled off, as it seems, so far without a major COVID outbreak, albeit the fact that the Tokyo and Japan in general continue to be in the middle of record numbers, but the competitors themselves didn't bring COVID and they didn't leave with it. So the Football Australia plan was as comprehensive as the one that had been put in place for Tokyo, even more so in many instances. They were planning about putting up nets at Bankwest Stadium and preventing any potential for the ball to go into the ground. So, yeah, if you're prepared to do that to get the game off the ground, then ultimately it's all about the politicians and the fact that they don't want to look bad to their constituents.
The return of the FFA Cup this season is proving increasingly difficult, with all matches postponed until at least the end of August. Football New South Wales' decision to scrap all 2021 matches has left their five qualified sides without avenue for match fitness or conditioning, although Football Australia has yet to give up on the comp altogether. Meanwhile, the Australian Professional Leagues are working through their plans for the upcoming A-League and W-League seasons. You'd assume COVID-19 will be making that particularly difficult. We reached out to the APL this week for an update. They said they're still finalising their plans and weren't willing to put anyone forward as yet. I also find that just a little bit... maybe a little bit confusing. I mean, the situation is that fluid and difficult, Rob, that no one expects them to have their plans locked in at the moment. I think you just need to put someone forward and have them, you know, basically keep us in the loop that they're working on it. Don't sort of leave us in the dark, as Football Australia seem to be doing with the FFA Cup as well. I mean, the only way you can get updates on the various postponements is to go onto the FFA Cup website, which is a relatively small website, and they're only drip-feeding that. So, again, don't leave us in the dark, both Football Australia and the APL.
Yeah, look, it's one of those situations where part of me wants to agree with every word you've said, that the other part is trying to be logical about it and understand that in all of the uncertainty with what's going on across the country, that it's impossible. I think there's just a lot of grey in this one, mate. So, you know, I think over the past 300 episodes, you know, I and Edge and you, everyone that's been on this show has never pulled a punch. But in this case, I think you've got to be reasonable and fair. And so I do have a bit of empathy for the situation. And, you know, I think we just have to cross our fingers that you know, if the numbers improve and the vaccination rates improve, that you know, as we're expecting them to over the next couple of months, that the competition will just have to be delayed.
Staying with the APL, they've hired Richard Bayliss as their first head of content. Bayliss joins from Optus Sport, where he's spent the past 5 years. The APL's media release reads his primary task will be to deliver multi-platform stories and news about football from Australia and around the world. Optus, Rob, I think we all agree, have done an exceptional job in moving football coverage into the digital age. Richard's been at the head of that. He's a regular guest on the program and a friend of ours, and we'll have him when he begins the role in mid-September join us on the show to chat about it. That's a huge acquisition.
Yeah, massive. Richard's been a great friend of this show, and he's been a wonderful host of Optus and an influential figure throughout. He's been there from the beginning, and you know, we've seen him from his start as a reporter at Channel 10 and then Foxtel. So hats off to Richard. I think he'll be a great acquisition. And insofar as content's concerned, that's one thing that we really need in the football landscape. We need more content, not less of it. We need more nuanced content. I think, Edge, you'd agree, we need podcasts, we need radio shows, we need football specialty shows on Optus and Foxtel and mainstream free-to-air channels.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a very, very good appointment. Richard's got a lot of experience in content creation, digital networks, the ability to develop reach and exposure for the APL. It's going to be difficult. Remember now that the APL is on their own. They don't have the Socceroos and Matildas to leverage from, which are really driving very big peak audiences. So we know that there's a long way back for the APL to come with their A-League coverage. So I think this is a very, very good appointment, and I'm excited to see what, you know, when Richard gets his feet under the table, what sort of strategy he puts together, and can the APL grow their footprint and eyeballs to generate more revenue for our sport, which is, as we know, desperately needed.
Excellent. All right, Willem, well done. Great start to the show. We're going to start our tribute shortly to Gerd Müller. We're going to talk to Chris Williams from the Gegenpress Bundesliga podcast. It's a great podcast. If you like to branch out from your traditional football viewing and listening habits, it really gets stuck into it. And they've done some wonderful work on the passing of the great striker, and Chris Williams has been front and centre of it. So we are looking forward to having a chat to him about Gerd Müller after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. And we like to think that we cover most of the stories when it comes to international football around the big players, the big name players. But there was none greater and none bigger than the passing this week of Gerd Müller at the age of just 75. He was an amazing player. He scored 566 goals in 600 games with Bayern. He scored 68 times in 62 internationals with Die Mannschaft. He won Golden Shoes, Golden Boots, Ballon d'Ors. And to talk about it with us is an expert on the Bundesliga, the host of the Gegenpress football podcast. And his name is Chris Williams. How are you, Chris?
I'm very well, thanks, guys. How are you?
Yeah, not at all. Thank you so much for joining us. And I know there's another breaking story, which we'll talk to you at the back end of this discussion around German football, another great striker. But for the moment, it's Gerd Müller. So insofar as his stature in the game, you know, people talk about Messi and Ronaldo and the big names of the modern era, and you know, we can cast back to any number of great name players, whether it's Cruyff or Puskas over the past three, four decades. But Müller sits comfortably alongside of those.
You know, 365 goals in 427 Bundesliga games. That's just league games, by the way. No other competitions. 66 goals, 74 European matches. He held a record for most goals scored in a season that stood for 40 years, and it was only broken by Lionel Messi. So that should give an indication for people who maybe haven't heard of him or have only slightly heard of him, his stature within the game. In Germany, he's regarded as the greatest striker ever, full stop, period. No other to be discussed. He's a World Cup winner, Ballon d'Or winner, scored a World Cup winning goal. You know, he's just a legend, really. He's been ill for some time, so his passing was expected, but that still doesn't make it any easier for everybody in Germany, and especially everybody at Bayern at the moment.
Chris, just for our Australian viewing, listening audience, he was only a small man, 173 centimetres, I think that was his height. He had a very low centre of gravity, but he had a trademark scoring technique. He scored a lot of goals from having his back to the goal, where he would swivel and shoot so fast that you know, that became a bit of a trademark. But what can you tell the Australian listeners, especially the contemporary ones, the younger ones that listen to our show, just how fantastic he was in the box? He was deadly, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he was. He said that I listened to an interview of him a few years ago now. He said that in order to be an effective striker, you had to be blind in the box. So you had to know where the goal was. It doesn't matter if you couldn't see. So yeah, you're quite right. His goal rates were scored with his back to the box. He just automatically knew where the goalkeeper is. Knew where the goal is and where the goalkeeper was, because he could often beat them. He said himself that he was, I think we call it, a fox in the box these days. He didn't score many goals from outside of the area. His back was to goal a lot of them, you're quite right. He just knew where the goal was, and that's always a good adage of a centre-forward. Pundits, commentators, podcasters, journalists always say he just seems to know where the goal is, and that was it. And he would score with anything: chest, head, knee, shin, boot, studs. He would score with every part of the body and every part of his equipment that he had on. He just knew where the goal was, and he could get that goal away. You look at goal scorers these days, so you look at Harry Kane, Lewandowski himself, Erling Haaland, they almost have the perfect finish every time. Gerd Müller could score from anywhere in the box, but he could also score a scruffy goal as well. And I think that's what's needed sometimes. You need someone to be able to just get in and around that box, in and around 2-3 yards, and just get something on the ball to poke it over. And he would get that. So not only could he score great goals from 12, 15 yards away inside the box, he could also get a really scruffy 1 yard goal as well.
And I'm sure he won't mind me saying this if he's listening, if he's up there in heaven listening to our little chat about how good he was here in to our Australian audience. But he was a little bit tubby too. He didn't mind just sort of turning up to play. Some of the reports I've read that he wasn't the greatest of trainers, but what he did do was just practice and practice and practice the shooting in the box. So it was good to see a tubby little bloke be one of the best players in the world.
Yeah, it is. I mean, football was a little bit different way back then. Obviously, the diet wasn't the same, and you know, players enjoyed a little bit more of a free lifestyle outside of the game. They weren't under strict nutritional requirements. So, yeah, I mean, he did. He does look quite unorthodox, really. If you see a picture of him, he doesn't look. I think you say he doesn't look like an athlete. Might be a little bit harsh. He just looks like a normal, everyday person, but could obviously just score a goal from anywhere. So a victory for the normal man, I think we can call that.
This is Box to Box, reflecting on the career of the great Gerd Müller. Passed away this week. Der Bomber was his nickname, with the host of the Gegen Press football podcast, Chris Williams. And Chris, Edge mentioned that, you know, he wasn't your sort of archetypal rippling six-pack kind of guy, but along with the incredible career he had, he did have his troubles, particularly after he retired. He did fall into alcoholism, fortunately managed to recover and develop a post-football career. But for a man who had such success, it was a sad decline there for a while.
Back in the 70s or 60s and 70s, we had footballers who would just stop playing a lot earlier normally in their careers, and they didn't really have that much to fall back on. So he went over to the United States and played out in the North American Soccer League towards the end. But that period of the game is littered with athletes who football almost turned their back on them, and they had to deal with the depression of not playing football anymore themselves. And he did sort himself out. He got into a coaching role with Bayern 2, so Bayern's reserve side, if you want to call it that. So yeah, he did turn himself round. But like a lot of players in that time, you know, it's not just George Best. There's a lot of players who went down the same sort of path, really. And you even have to look at some of the greats like Diego Maradona. It's trying to replicate that high that they get on the football pitch once they come off it. It tends to not be able to, and unfortunately sometimes they look for other things. But yeah, he'll be remembered for everything he did on the pitch, and the way he did it. He was a very good player, a very humble player, had a little bit of a fight in him, but was always quite fair.
Well, Müller's record of 14 World Cup goals scored in 13 games over two tournaments held up until 2006, when Brazil's Ronaldo scored his 15th goal in his 19th World Cup game. So that just gives you an indication of the nature of his scoring. But the last question before Rob asks you about Robert Lewandowski and some news that's sort of coming out of Germany on that, just on Gerd Müller, what has been the reaction in Germany? Has it been, you know, front and back pages of the newspapers, the talk shows, the television stations? Has it been wall-to-wall coverage of it? Is he... held in a regard similar to the Brazilians would hold Pelé and the Argentinians would hold Maradona? Is it that type of reverence that he has?
Yeah, especially in the sports media itself. It's translated into everyday media because obviously he's such a well-known figure for that generation of football fans. But yeah, sports media, most definitely. You look at the traditional shows in Germany, like Doppelpass, etc., and It's been a coverage on Gerd Müller, reflections on his life, on his career, how good he was. Obviously, we've got Lewandowski, who's broken a couple of his records, but will we ever see a goal scorer like that again? It's a bit of a rhetorical question. He's once in a generational talent, and his time at Bayern will live forever, not just in the records and the goals he got, but also just the person he was. And of course, for Germany as well, you know, the records that he had, Miroslav Klose, it took to 2014 to get past his record there. As you said, he won the Ballon d'Or. I think it was about 8 hat-tricks he scored for Germany. So it's exceptional level of performance. And yeah, that's why the coverage in Germany has been really high. And obviously, because he's associated with Bayern, who are the biggest club, the Rekordmeister. There's been a lot of coverage and a lot of nice reflection. As I say, he was ill, so it was expected, but that still doesn't make it less shocking. The tributes have been flowing in.
No, exactly. Great memories of a great football player, and what a wonderful segue to Lewandowski, who we mentioned. The story appears to be breaking, not guaranteed as we go to air, that he wants to get out of his contract at Bayern. Now, Bayern are coming off 9 consecutive wins. It's the post-Hansi Flick era. Julian Nagelsmann is in charge. They've won the Super Cup, but they lost the opening friendlies before a draw in the first round of the Bundesliga. What's your take on this? Do you expect it to happen? Is it a negotiation ploy from the broadcaster or the club? Are we going to see him in a sky blue shirt at Manchester City?
It's always a strange one. So he's under contract until 2023. He's 32. He's 33 in 2 days. He's probably looking at making a step to a new club. I don't think he's got anything to prove at Bayern. Obviously, I think we can all agree, had France football not cancelled the Ballon d'Or, he would have won the Ballon d'Or last season. He won the FIFA best player. Obviously, he got a Champions League trophies. He's got 9 titles with Bayern. He's got 4 Pokals. Terrific player. What more can he win with Bayern? He's probably realising he's got one last contract in him, be that 1 year or be that 2 year. Probably a 2 year contract left in him, maybe a 3 at the most. But he wanted to try Real Madrid at one point, heavily linked, pushed for a move. Bayern said no. And we have to remember, he scored 297 goals in 331 appearances for Bayern. So you don't replace that easily. In fact, it's probably almost impossible to replace. So while he is 33, almost, and they've stuck a price tag of 120 million on him, around about £100 million, that is a lot of money, but that's for them to replace him. He's certainly not worth that to a buying club, but he's worth that as in how much he would cost to replace. I don't think there's any player currently that could replace him. Maybe Erling Haaland, maybe Mbappe. But yeah, for Bayern, I'm had it been 2-3 years ago, I would have said maybe he's angling for a better contract. Now, I genuinely think he wants to try somewhere new. Whether his agent will get that is a different question. Do Bayern let him go, or do they make him stay and make him retire there? He's obviously come from Borussia Dortmund, so he did travel into Bayern. He's not come from Bayern as a youth player. If you look at Gerd Müller, who came from the amateur stages or the lower leagues into Bayern, he came from one of their title rivals after winning the title. So will they let him move on? It's a bit of a strange question. I think if the price is right and they get an offer, perhaps they do, because he's proven himself to the Bayern board time and time again. But there's always that, how do we replace him?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. When we saw Lionel Messi finally leave, we thought, well, anything can happen, so it wouldn't be surprising. I was listening to Robert Klein, the CEO of the Bundesliga, on your podcast, the Gegen Press podcast, just this last episode, and he talks up an amazing game for the competition and the roundedness of the competition, the rising stars, the other players. So you lose one star, other stars rise. So we'll watch this space. Chris, we'll let you get back to that breaking story. Thank you for joining us to reflect on Gerd Müller and talk a bit about Lewandowski as well. We really do recommend your podcast, the Gegen Press podcast. And for anyone who doesn't know, Gegen Press is the style that the great Jurgen Klopp has made famous, the pressing style, which we have all come to be familiar with over recent years. Chris, thanks so much for joining us, mate.
Gents, thanks very much.
Yep, you stay well, Chris Williams. Get onto that podcast. You'll absolutely love it if you're a genuine football fan, and we suspect that if you're listening to this show, well, you probably are. All right, stick around after the break. Sydney FC captain and head of the president of the PFA, Alex Wilkinson. It's very uncertain times in football in this country. We're a couple of months away from the A-League kicking off. We'd be interested to talk to Chris on his thoughts from the player's point of view on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. It is a busy show. This half hour, we're going to focus on the domestic league. We're going to talk to Brandon O'Neill at the back half of the hour. But before we do, we have got the man who's in charge at Sydney FC. But not only is he in charge at Sydney FC, he's the captain of that club, but he's the president of the Professional Footballers Association, Alex Wilkinson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's been uncertain times. The entire playing fraternity is concerned about what is happening, of course, as every professional sports person is. We see the other competitions around the country and other sports getting their competitions up and off the ground. We know that the A-League played in a hub for much of last season. So what can you tell us about what you're hearing from the head office at the moment and how players training and things all coming together?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think in terms of what we're hearing for the start of the season, it's at the moment, I think it's just going to go ahead as planned, or they're planning to start. I think it's around the end of October or the start of November for the kickoff of this new season. But you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, Danny Townsend and the rest of the APL have got a few different plans in place, because obviously the situation's changing, you know, daily, on a daily basis in pretty much every state around Australia at the moment. So obviously I don't envy their job at the moment in terms of logistically trying to plan a season. But I guess, look, from a player's point of view, I'm pretty sure most of the teams are back training now. And yeah, we're just grateful as a football playing group that we can train together at the moment, and we can still continue, I guess, you know, working and continuing to earn a living, because a lot of people, I guess, around Australia at the moment are facing that sort of uncertainty. And, you know, we saw in the last couple of seasons that players have sacrificed a lot to continue playing and to continue producing a product that, you know, everyone can watch and people can tune into. And, you know, hopefully this season can get up and running without too many glitches. But like I said, I think we're going to have to be pretty flexible in how things go, because things are changing so quickly.
Just the genesis behind getting behind the vaccination message, and did that come from the club, or was that a player-driven thing? And just give us your thoughts on how important it is for people to go and get the jab.
Yeah, look, that was a initiative that was driven by the club, but, you know, I think us as players realise the importance of it. And like I said before, we've been lucky enough to be able to continue working and continue to be able to train together. But a lot of people, you know, are severely affected by this pandemic and have lost jobs or are unable to work and lost income. And, you know, it's a terrible time for a lot of people around Australia. So I guess the quicker we can you know, get out of this, and the quicker we can remedy it with vaccinations and everything else we're doing in terms of lockdowns and certain restrictions, you know, that's going to be the better for everyone across Australia, not just, you know, us as footballers. So, you know, I know I've just had my first vaccination last week, so I'm waiting a couple of weeks till I get my second, and quite a few of the boys are on that same path at the moment. So the more that we can get done, the better.
James Jonicky has joined your club this year, so if we can read anything into that addition, you might have a new partner in the centre of defence. Have you played with James previously anywhere in any sort of competition, or how is he settling into training?
Yeah, he's settling in really well. I haven't played with Donks before, but obviously being in the A-League for a while now, and we played against each other plenty of times, so we got to know each other just through regularly running into each other every, you know, three times a year or whenever, how many times we play each other. And he's settled in really well along with the rest of the other boys who've come in. We haven't had wholesale changes this year. You know, we haven't sort of, that's been our, I guess, philosophy and the way we've done things at Sydney FC is due to the success we've had over the recent seasons. We haven't made a lot of changes every year, but we've just tinkered with things, and inevitably there's always going to be a few changes every year. And you know, we've had three or four again this year, and Donks has come up from having a spell over in India, which he said he enjoyed, but he's happy to be back in Australia now. And it's great to have him on board. He's a quality player, and he's going to add, you know, a lot of depth to our lineup. That's for sure.
Yeah, he definitely will. And it has been a little bit interesting watching the movement in players, and it's that time of the calendar, isn't it, where clubs are announcing new signings and people that are transferring and Australians coming back from overseas to play. And Sydney, you just guys seem to have a very core nucleus of the team that doesn't change. How important is stability to success? Does stability always guarantee success, or can you have success without stability? I mean, how important is it for Sydney, that core group of players going around year after year?
Yeah, I think that's something that we as a club have done really well over the last 5 or 6 years, is that we've kept that core group of players together. And like I said, there is always changes come the start of a new season and people leaving and whatnot. But the people we've brought in every year have added quality and added to the squad in different ways and continue to strengthen us. And, you know, that's just the way we've done things. But obviously you can't have, you know, stability if the results aren't there. You know, there's no point in keeping, you know, a team together if you're not being successful. So I think it's sort of works both ways there. But, you know, we've been lucky enough, I guess, to have quite a lot of success over the last 5 or 6 seasons. So I guess that's sort of paved the way to keep that continuance in the squad and to keep that core group together because of the success we've had on the pitch. And, you know, hopefully it can continue this year.
With stability comes expectation, but this season will be one of those rare seasons over recent times where you don't go into the opening matches as favourites after City's victory last year. Admittedly, you'll be one of the top faves, but you know, speaking of victory, we'll be expecting them to bounce back. Lots of other clubs who performed above expectations last year. Is it nice sometimes to go in as, well, you're not an underdog at Sydney FC, would never be described as that, but without the weight of favouritism on your shoulders?
We don't really buy into it too much, to be fair, the external sort of stuff. It's more, you know, we as a group, because of the success we've had in the last sort of, you know, medium to short term, I guess we sort of put the pressure on ourselves to perform. We you know, we expect to be at the top of the table come season's end, and you know, if we're not there, we're pretty disappointed. So you know, we don't really feel the external pressure. It's more the pressure that the players and the coaching staff, and I guess being at a club like Sydney FC, put on ourselves. So you know, we'll be looking to go better than last year. We've you know, pulled up a little bit short in both the Premiership and the Grand Final last year. So a little bit disappointing not to come home with a trophy. And you know, we'll need to improve because a lot of clubs across the league have strengthened and have improved their squads. So we'll need to do the same to make sure we're right up there again.
Well, the season doesn't kick off till late October, so hopefully, as you said at the top of this chat, there will be some continuity in so far as the pre-season is concerned, and we'll be able to get stuck into the season with crowds in the stadiums and a lot of hope for an exciting season ahead. Alex, thanks so much for joining us, mate. You stay well, and we'll look forward to the footy starting about a month and a half from now.
Yeah, let's hope so, guys. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Alex Wilkinson, captain of Sydney FC, one of the statesmen of football in this country. Now, before we go to the break, we're in our 300th episode, and I can guarantee you one thing is for sure, that there is no way we would have even had one episode if it hadn't have been for our friends at Chemist Warehouse, the great Mario Tosconi, Rutene Farakawa. They have supported us since day one, and they will be listening out there and proud, I'm sure, of what they were responsible for creating. But if you want to support them, the only way to do that is to get into their stores, because there is a certain Father's Day coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Now, if you're in one of the lockdown states, as many of us are, some of you out there won't be, so you can get there anyway. But right now, you can get free shipping on all fragrance orders delivered direct to your dad. There's the David Beckham Refined Woods Eau de Parfum, just $39.99. That's nearly $20 off, $19.01 off the recommended retail price. The Calvin Klein Defy Eau de Toilette 50 mils, Calvin Klein CK1 200 mils for $32.99. The deals are all over the place. So if you want to look after your dad, you can get some of those David Beckham inspired fragrances. You can get Calvin Klein. You can get just about any brand it is that you want and send it straight to your dad's door. Or if you're not in lockdown, you can deliver it to him yourself. It's Father's Day in a couple of weeks' time, so don't delay. Get into Chemist Warehouse, as I'm sure your daughters will, Michael, and I hope that my fellas will themselves. Okay, that is a wrap on that. We're going to continue to talk A-League. Brendan O'Neill, he's had a tour through the Southeast Asian climbs. He's had an incredible story with his family, losing his dad, his wife pregnant. We're going to hear it all from Brendan after the break. Stick around. It's guaranteed to be one that'll tug the heartstrings. Next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. It's our 300th episode, and it's a local and it's an international episode, but we're going to stick with the local theme after talking to Alex Wilkinson from Sydney FC before the break. We now have one of our favourite veterans of Australian football, former Socceroo. He's played in various countries around the world, but he's back in his hometown now. Brendan O'Neill, how are you, mate?
Hello, lads. Very well, very well. How are you?
Yeah, we're really good, Brandon, and it's great to have you back home. You've been in Thailand, and it's been an interrupted season as well in South Korea as well. But you're back home, and by all accounts, reading your comments that you and your family are delighted to be back in Perth.
We are indeed. It's been leaving Sydney a couple of years ago. I never thought. I never thought my journey would take me on, I guess, a life-changing experience for myself and my family, something we had to prepare for, and for it to kind of be the way it has done. I'm very happy, and I'm very very excited to finally be home.
So, Brandon, it's just been such a difficult time, a roller coaster of emotions with the tragic loss of your dad, and then the beautiful news of the impending arrival of a little baby. Just tell us from your own words how that experience has been for you.
Yeah, it's been one hell of a journey. I've learned a lot about myself, and a lot of things were put into perspective quite quickly, and suddenly as life throws a few curveballs at you. And leaving Sydney, I obviously knew of my dad's condition. He had lung cancer, it was stage 3 at the time, and he was my biggest fan, my inspiration, and he was probably the first one kicking me on the flight to get to South Korea, and because he knows how hard I have worked and how hard I'll continue to work until I can't play the game anymore, in order to just get the best out of myself. And so we jumped on a flight to Korea, and within the space of maybe 8 months, he was hospital bound then, and we received a call in Korea, just kind of giving us the news that look, it had changed to his diagnosis as being terminal. My mum actually got a do not resuscitate that she had to sign when we were in Korea, and me and my wife Nicole, we just kind of looked at each other and said, look, we need to get back and we need to see him. And so we jumped back on a flight. We did our 2 weeks quarantine. He was in hospital at the time, and he was probably given a few months, which was all the time I needed to spend some quality time with him. He got a little bit better in hospital as we kind of neared the end to quarantine. I got out and I was able to spend two of the best probably months of my life with him. Every single day waking up, having a coffee, just doing father and son things and having life chats about things we never really touched on. In the whole of that emotional journey, myself and Nicole received a life change and moved to Thailand, and that was probably one of the easiest, hardest decisions I've ever had to make to set up myself and my family's future, but to also leave my best mate, a terminally ill person, that was it was one of the hardest things possibly I've ever had to do. And again, my dad being my dad, again, he was the first one to keep me on that plane. And the life chats we had before that deal came, it kind of made things a little bit easier in his eyes, because someone, I guess, from a small little part of Perth, in a big family, and we don't want for much. We pride ourselves on love. We have a big family, and to get this opportunity to go over there and set my family's life up, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen to someone like me, and it shouldn't happen to someone like our family. So we were very fortunate again, and it puts things into perspective. We went over there, and again, another amazing journey. But ultimately, it came to the end of the season. We were away in off season, and my wife got brand new. Probably the best news I guess a husband can get, that we were expecting our first child. And within a matter of a day being told that, she got violently ill. And you forget that Thailand, unfortunately, probably hasn't got the best medical systems that Australia has. So we went to hospital, and that was a massive eye opener for myself. And then unfortunately the next day after that, we've got Nicole home, and I got the call from my mum saying that my dad's only been given a few days. So with everything that was going on, someone somewhere was saying to Brano, it's time to get home. You've been away, and you've experienced what you need to experience, and you've done what you needed to do.
Brandon, you played for the big daddy of Thailand football, Buriram United. I've spent some time in Thailand, so I just know how much of a super club they are. Can you tell us about what it was like living in Buriram and being a player on the most supported club in Thailand and playing in front of 45,000 people at their stadium?
Yeah, look, it was absolutely amazing. To put it into context, we go out and we pop to Woolies and Coles, and we go to the beach and we have our coffees, and we just wear normal clothes. We go out in whatever we want. And over in Buriram, it's just an out and out football town. There's not a person that doesn't go out without a Buriram jersey on. You see young lads walking in the shops with the full kit on sometimes. It is just absolutely chock-a-blocked with Buriram jerseys, and they live for football. So as you could imagine, I'm a ranger with freckles, an Irish lad, and my wife's got blonde hair and blue eyes, and we're sat in a coffee shop. We stick out like a sore thumb. So it was an amazing opportunity for myself and Nicole to kind of give back, to have our pictures taken and speak to the younger lads and the older people of Buriram, and really kind of embrace ourselves in the culture of Thai, I guess, Thai lifestyle and Thai football. But when COVID had settled down over there, our first home game was the following week that air restrictions were lifted, and they got a packed out stadium of 45,000 to our last four games. And the closest thing I've ever felt to European football, the atmosphere, the noise, was absolutely incredible. It gave me memories that, again, someone from a small little town in Perth, a little suburb in Perth, should never have gotten. I'm extremely grateful I got to experience it.
Hey, Brandon, look, we'd love to talk to you more about your story, your experiences, but you're back in Perth, and I suspect that, in a month and a half, maybe 2 months when the A-League starts, we'll be talking to you again as the excitement builds to what is a new era in the A-League in this country. Good luck to all of your family. Our hearts are with you, mate, and we're so pleased to hear a smile on your face after everything you've been through, and good luck with the arrival of the little one in the not too far distant future.
No, thank you very much. I really appreciate the support, lads. And yeah, whenever everyone a chat, I'm always free and up for one. So thank you so much.
We'll take you up on that, my friend. All right, stick around. Next hour on Box to Box, we're going to talk to our good mate Rob Tanner to celebrate our 300th episode. We'll talk more Europe with the boys and some special memories of the past 300 episodes on the show. That's after the news on Box to Box.
Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbus and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
for Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
Absolutely fantastic!
Welcome back to Box Second Edition News with Willem van Dender and shortly our mate from The Athletic to celebrate our 300th show, Rob Tanner, to talk all about the Premier League. More European news with Dino and Dell, and we'll wrap it up with some memories of the past 5 or 6 years in stoppage time. But Willem, you got a stack more news.
I do, Rob. Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army. It's over 3 years now since I decided to join the Green and Gold Army myself for the World Cup in Russia, and it remains one of the best decisions I've ever made. It's already time to start thinking about going again. I can't believe it. To make sure you're there this time, head to ggatravel.com.au and sign up to the mailing list to be among the first to know when info arises about not just the World Cup, but all overseas Socceroos and Matilda's tours. We've got an international retirement to touch on first up. Ivy Lewick has called time on her Matilda's career after 34 appearances across 11 years. Lewick debuted for the Matildas against New Zealand in 2010 and was part of their Asian Cup triumph later that year. After stretches out of the side across the journey, she worked her way back into calculations ahead of the Olympics and played in 3 of the 5 matches just gone in Tokyo. Michael, a versatile player, maybe probably one that I respect, the type of athlete that I respect the most. Not the most blessed or gifted, but worked for every one of those Matildas caps and got the most out of herself when called upon.
And she's much loved, Ivy Lewick. Within the group of players in the Matildas and the W League, she's hugely respected for the volume of work she's done and the places that she's played football right around the world. It's been an incredible journey. She's a lovely, lovely lady with enormous talent. But she also got the most out of her footballing capacity too. She had 3 extremely good seasons when Melbourne City had those 3 championship wins in a row. She was a really big part of those, playing in the number 6 role. But Elise Kellett-Knight kept her out of the starting lineup for a long time when they were sort of vying for that defensive midfield position. And Ivy, you know, she finally got her opportunity at the Women's World Cup in France, and she got on the pitch for the match against Jamaica. And she also obviously got on the pitch at the recent Tokyo 2020 Olympics. So well done, Ivy. I dipped my lid to you. You've put in a great shift, and you can be extremely proud of your contribution to our fantastic sport and the Matildas. You're a star.
You were a big fan of her for a long time there, Edge, when she was on the outer. You always talked her up, and you ended up being right. She ended up getting picked, and she did really well when she came back in, didn't she?
She certainly did, yeah. As I said, Rob, she's got the respect of everyone involved in the women's game. She's got a level head. She forms fabulous relationships with everybody she plays with in the W League and takes an interest in their careers, even if they move on to other clubs, not to mention her leadership around the Matildas team. So well done, Ivy, and she'll be getting thousands and thousands of goodwill messages after this announcement, no doubt.
Another much-loved Matilda is on the move, Hayley Rasso, joining Manchester City on a 2-year deal this week, declaring that fighting for her position and playing Champions League were big factors behind the move. She leaves Everton after 22 appearances last season that saw her score 5 goals and produce 2 assists. Michael, another one of your favourites going a step up. She had some scintillating spells with Everton, particularly in their FA Cup run at the start of last season, but also had some quieter periods out of the side. How's she going to shape up at City?
Well, it's a big move, isn't it? They're the big dog in one of the big dogs in women's football in England. They set their sights on Champions League. She'll have to fight for a spot there, but I think she's like wherever she goes, Hayley. She gets in the hearts of club fans, and Everton will sadly miss her. But the kamikaze kid, as I call her, she only plays with one speed, and that's full pelt. She'll do well. She'll get into that team and do very well. And you know, she's got a bit of a challenge at the moment. The way Tony Gustafsson set up the team, he's got her playing in a unfamiliar position for her in terms of her career and where she sort of got the most out of herself. So, yeah, this will be good for her. Hopefully, it's a good deal financially. But Hayley Rasso, she's a star. We love her. We love her lots.
Still only 26, so plenty of good football ahead of her as well. On to the gents. Tom Rogic has been in cracking form for Celtic as they've won 5 on the bounce, placing him firmly in the frame for a Socceroos recall. Rogic played his part in what was an amazing first half against Hearts in their League Cup match last weekend and also set up a goal in the Europa League qualifier against AZ Alkmaar with a beautiful cross. And over to Japan to finish. Yokohama F. Marinos have produced their best game under Kevin Muscat so far, putting five past Wita Trinita in the J-League. They're 6 points off top spot with 14 to play, so still plenty of time for Muskie and the Marinos to put forward a serious chance at the title. And Adam Tagan and Mitch Duke both found the net for Setsuzo Osaka and Okayama in Japan. And some good news to finish. The Socceroos have moved to a 10-year high on the FIFA rankings. They're up to 35th after four consecutive wins in June. Some huge transfer news over the past week, or perhaps still yet to play out. Harry Kane has not travelled to Portugal for Tottenham's clash with Paços de Ferreira as he continues to push for a move away from the club. Kane was absent as Spurs beat Man City in the league last week, but has returned to training with their next clash against Wolves on Sunday. Spurs chairman Daniel Levy has rebuffed Man City's offer of £125 million, reportedly holding out for £160, which sounds a little bit greedy to me, Rob. If a player who's given the service at Kane has done wants to move on for that sort of price, I'd be letting him go. And although the Man City move could well be off, because as we heard earlier, City now have their eyes on Robert Lewandowski.
I know. Isn't it amazing how quickly the story can change? I mean, Jack Grealish had the record signing, not the kind of debut he would have expected, and Harry Kane would have just done so well had he been in the Manchester City lineup with the kind of service that he would have gotten. It didn't happen. City lost. This club won with him on the sidelines. So, yeah, it's just an amazing turn of events that this Lewandowski story has thrown into the mix, because obviously there's no way in the world that they're going to sign both, and Harry might just have to stay.
Over to Spain, Barcelona president Juan Laporta has accused his predecessor Josep Bartomeu of leaving a terrible inheritance, with it revealed the club is 1.35 billion euros in debt. Laporta admitted the club's wage bill represents 103% of their total income, significantly up on other La Liga clubs, and that the re-signing of Lionel Messi would have seen that balloon to 110%. The club have requested an 80 million euro loan to kickstart their finances and were able this week to sign three free agents after Gerard Piqué agreed to a pay cut. There was a bit of back and forth between the two presidents, a bit of a slanging match. Not particularly relevant though, Rob. What is relevant is that for the first time, we've got a little bit of clarity around the numbers. For a long time, it's been quite murky. Oh, Barca are in trouble. There's a lot of debt. But at least this week, they've come out and have been upfront around a few of the figures.
Yeah, but the figures just keep on doubling, don't they? And so what do you believe? You know, the way that Barcelona are going financially, you've got to question whether they're a going concern. Obviously, La Liga stepped in and ensured that they didn't sign Messi to an unsustainable contract. But, yeah, look, it's just a shocking set of news. And you've just got to wonder how La Liga is going to be able to provide the kind of finances that Barcelona need to come back from where they are in the short to medium term with Messi not playing in the competition. What about you, Edge? What do you think?
Brand Finance have come out with some interesting numbers around the cost impact to Barcelona with Messi's departure. They're saying that their brand will be decreased, the brand value decreased by about 11% or 137 million euros. Messi's shirt sales alone generated Barca 200 million euros in revenue, of which they generated royalties of 15%. His 30-plus seasonal goals need to be replaced. Those goals, as we know, drove titles, matchday audiences. You know, Barcelona estimates, Brand Finance estimates that Barca, they might lose as much as 17 million euros in gate revenue. Not to mention his huge personal following, estimated at 240 million people, who are effectively just going to go across to PSG. PSG grew their Instagram followers by 6.8 million people in the first 12 hours after Messi's announcement of being signed. So Barca have more problems than their debt. They've got to replace the impact of Leo Messi in the club, which, in my view, is irreplaceable.
Carly Lloyd, she has announced that she's going to play the remainder of the National Women's Soccer League season and four upcoming internationals before retiring. She debuted for the US as a 22-year-old in 2005. She's played 312 games, scoring 128 goals as she's collected two World Cup winners' medals and two Olympic gold medals. Her career started way back in 1999 with the Central Jersey Splash. She also picked up the FA Cup with Manchester City along the way. So congratulations to a Titan of the women's game. All the best for the rest of her career and into retirement.
Willem, her three best games, believe it or not, 2008, she scored the winner in the USA won Brazil nil gold medal game at the Olympics. In 2012, she scored a double in the gold medal game of the Olympics, 2-1 over Japan. And in 2015, China had the USA pinned in a World Cup quarterfinal, and she scored a late blistering header to get the USA over China, and they went on to win that tournament. So I think they're her three best games. She was, and still is, as a result of her performance against Australia in the bronze medal playoff. She's pretty good at 39 years of age. We'd take her.
Yeah, we would. Well, and Carly Lloyd definitely deserved the rap that she got by extending our news just a little bit. All right, guys, sit tight. We're going to talk to our good mate. We've talked to him so many times since this show started, way back when he was with the Leicester Mercury, when the Foxes were doing the unthinkable and 5,000-1. He wrote the book, Rob Tanner from The Athletic. We're going to talk Premier League next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving, and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
This is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. Well, it wouldn't be our 300th episode if we didn't talk to our favourite guest. And yes, we've had a lot of favourite guests over the journey, but there is no more favourite than Rob Tanner. We met him when he was with the Leicester Mercury, and he's stuck with us from the time that the Mighty Foxes broke out. He wrote that book, 5,000-1. He's with The Athletic now, and he's introduced us to so many people over the journey. None of them would be on this show without Rob Tanner. How are you, Rob?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Mate, we're super well, Rob. Before I hand it over to the boys to ask a couple of questions, we did talk to Chris Williams from the Gegenpress Bundesliga podcast, and you know, we tribute to Maradona last year when he passed, and we talk about all the big names on this show. But Gerd Müller, what an amazing player! How would you describe his impact on English football, given that he played with the mighty German side, and there were plenty of heartbreaks at the hands of that side for England?
Well, yeah, and most notably the 70 World Cup in Mexico, when he was the focal point of their magnificent comeback to knock out the world champions, England. So, yeah, but obviously Gerd Müller, a fantastic poacher, goal poacher. You know, he was come alive in the penalty box and so difficult to contain. He just had that natural instinct. You can't coach it. You know, that instinct just to be in the right place at the right time to score so many goals. And I don't think his stats will ever be matched again in the game.
Rob, Premier League has started again. Nice to be back after the short break. It was a fantastic first weekend, wasn't it? I think the average number of goals was 3 to 4 per game. The Premier League really just exploded back to life, didn't it?
Absolutely, and with fans back as well, which was so amazing. And I think my boss is getting sick to death of people saying, isn't it great to have fans back? And he even threatened me with the sack if I even wrote about how great it was to have fans back. But it truly is. I mean, to see them there in numbers and getting behind, I think that's one of the factors in so many goals, because the teams have just played with a bit of a freedom in the first week, which normally it's cagey in the opening few weeks of the season, but we've just seen sides go for it. And I mean, unfortunately, I was at a game where there was only one goal, but what a goal it was from Jamie Vardy. But it was a fantastic opening weekend.
Yeah, that was a good goal, you're right. And the other game that was quite tight was Tottenham Hotspur 1, Manchester City 0. Tottenham sort of turning the tables a bit. No one expected much from them. And City, you know, for defending champions, not a great start. I've got to ask about Harry Kane, of course. Does this just... Do you think increased City's need to go and buy that striker, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've got a terrible record at Tottenham anyway, Man City. I mean, they never seem to do anything there. And it's first game for Nuno's, and you can see he's set out his stall how Spurs are going to play under him. It's going to be quite defensive. They're going to sit back like Wolves did and try and counter-attack, and they did that effectively against Manchester City. But you're right, Manchester City are crying out for a centre-forward. I know Pep sometimes doesn't play with one, but they need a focal point to that attack. Otherwise, it just looks a little bit blunt. It's going to be interesting what's going to happen over the last couple of weeks of the transfer window, because there's a few deals that could get done. And that one is the one everybody's looking at. Harry, he's not travelled with the Spurs squad for their Europa League game tonight as either. So claiming he's not ready for match action. So this is going to go down to the wire. I think Spurs will stand strong and they'll want 150 million for him at least. And by spending 100 million on Jack Grealish, they've sort of set a rod for their own back, Man City, because Spurs will quite rightly say, well, you've spent 100 million pounds on a player who's just only broken into the England team. This is the England captain we're talking about and the Premier League top goal scorer for a number of seasons. So they're going to hold out for their valuation.
You mentioned some transfer activity, and one place where transfers could be happening is Arsenal. Martin Odegaard looks on the verge of coming back after his loan spell on a permanent deal. And Ramsdale, the goalkeeper, left out of the Sheffield United squad. Do you think, you know, given Arsenal's terrible start against Brentford, do you think a flashy sort of midfielder and a goalkeeper is what Arsenal need right now?
They'd probably need more than that. They probably need more than that as well. I mean, it was a terrible start, and you just have to question in what direction Arsenal are going in under Arteta. And a lot of their transfer policy, it always seems to be reactionary. It always seems to be a bit of a panic about it. I mean, Odegaard they've had previously on loan, so they know a bit about him. But you know, but besides that, I mean, they were heavily linked with James Maddison, but they never came in for him. It was a lot of speculation and rumour, and that was, you can guess where that might have come from, but they don't seem to have a clear philosophy like Leicester do in the transfer market.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to Rob Tanner. We're talking Premier League. Rob Tanner from The Athletic on Box to Box.
Rob, you were obviously at the Leicester game, and you mentioned it before. Jamie Vardy's goal was exquisite. The technical capacity for him to do that was amazing. And I just wanted to sort of delve into it a little bit. There's been a lot said about the fact that he really switches off in the off-season while, you know, he only scored four goals in the second half of Leicester's 2021 Premier League campaign. And that did come in very condensed fixturing, you know, games every 3 or 4 days, which I don't think suit him. But there's reports that he sat on the couch, had a few beers, played with these five kids. Yes, for our listeners out there, he's got five kids. Is that the sort of guy he is? And he looks fresh. He ran his backside off the full game, and he was the difference in getting a win. So I think Vardy can take Leicester a long way this year again, even at 34 years of age. I just want you to comment on all of that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the key for Jamie is rest. I mean, last season, he was the focal point of the attack, and you could see in the second half of the season, especially after he had that groin issue, that he was fading, he was struggling for the same energetic performances. And Kelechi Iheanacho stepped up and then broke his run of being the club's top goal scorer at the end of the season. People are looking at the arrival of Patson Daka, who is going to be his successor. He plays in a similar way, plays on the shoulder of the last man, likes to run in behind, got fantastic pace. But instead of being the beginning and the end for Jamie Vardy, I think Daka's arrival will give longevity to his Leicester City career, because now it's not all about Jamie. It's not, the focal point isn't all on him. He doesn't have to go out and play two games a week every week, because his body can't deal with that. He needs the rest. He needs a couple of beers and a sit down on the couch. But Daka is going to come in and give him that opportunity to get that rest, so he can remain fresh and firing all season long. It's going to be so important for him. And he's got 2 years left on his contract. I mean, I think there's 10 players in total, Leicester, have got 2 years left on their contract. So they'll be trying to sort that out. And as I'm speaking to you now, they've just announced a new deal for Harvey Barnes for 4 years. That's the future. The immediate future, though, Jamie Vardy is going to be still so important to the club, not just with his performances, his natural goal-scoring instinct. We just talked about Gerdie Muller and that finish, getting across Connor Cody to get a little touch on into the far corner. That is going to be so crucial again this season for them.
Certainly is. What about Tottenham? Nuno Santos' first Premier League fixture in charge. He rolled out a 4-3-3 setup, but Dele Alli, who we see as a sort of an out and out attacker, he seemed to love a new role. He was extremely defensive. He didn't get in the box very often, but his defensive work it really stood out to me. I checked after the game; he had 12 tackles. That's the most he's had in a Spurs shirt. His box-to-box running was elite. Could Nuno Santo, could he re-engage and redefine the Dele Alli that we've been watching? And is this a rebirth of him, potentially?
Well, time will tell with that. I mean, obviously, he didn't get on with Jose Mourinho and was basically left out in the cold, and his career certainly stalled. I mean, he was an England regular, and then he fell out in a massive way with Mourinho. So whenever a new manager comes in, it's a chance for a fresh start for players, and it looks like one for Dele. I agree with you. He looked more like a number eight box to box than a number 10. He is. That was the area of his game that needed refining, was the defensive side of it, because you need that as well at the top level. You know, you can't just be the guy that causes a lot of damage and drifts into goal scoring positions. You need to be able to work backwards as well. All the best players, all the top players can do that. So he needed to add that to his game, and he's got a coach that now that will work with him on that. I mean, I'm not saying Mourinho isn't a defensive coach, because that was labelled at him as well, but it looks like Nuno's got belief in him from the outset, and he's going to give him that opportunity.
Hey, Rob, I noticed the guys, both Arsenal fans that they are, have avoided the obvious return to power of Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp. I know Norwich City might not have been the powerhouse, but with Virgil van Dijk back up at the back, they are right up in this competition, right up to their neck. What's your assessment of them? Do you think that they can put last season's disappointment behind them and challenge for the title?
Well, they certainly have the players to do that. Whether they've got the strength in depth, I mean, all their rivals have been spending huge amounts of money this summer. I mean, we talk about the impact of the pandemic, but the top sides, the top clubs have dug deep. I mean, we've talked about Man City spending, with Chelsea as well, Lukaku, how much they've spent on that particular deal. Liverpool, the noise from Jurgen Klopp is that they haven't got that sort of money to compete, but they have got the players. It's if they got keep people fit this season, having fans back in Anfield would be huge as well. If they can do those, both those factors can really boost them, and I can see them challenging this season. I mean, my favourites are still Man City, even though, you know, obviously they looked off it the first week. But I think they'll be up there as well with Man City, challenging with Chelsea. Those three will be the three that I can see really going close to the title this season.
And we're going to let you go, Rob, without mentioning Brentford. What an amazing start that was. And I asked this, I asked this with no desire to upset the boys even more. But Arsenal were absolutely ordinary, as you've already said. But Brentford under Thomas Frank, are they going to actually do something this season? I'm not saying that they're going to challenge for the title, but will they be a troublesome side throughout the season for various clubs that come to the community stadium?
Absolutely. It's a great atmosphere, that place, as well, when you go down there. I mean, it's a real community club. They're galvanised. Obviously, everybody's fired up for this season, being back in the Premier League. Well, being in the Premier League, but being back in the top flight of English football. It's been a long, long time. That will carry them so far, and they'll ride that wave for the start of the season. Then it gets into that tricky period around Christmas. Then we'll see whether they've genuinely got enough to survive. It's going to be tough for any side coming up. I mean, we saw Sheffield United first season up. They had a great season. Second season, terrible. And they're back in the Championship and struggling and getting whacked by West Bromwich Albion on the, you know, as they did last night. So, you know, they can ride that so far, but then they've got to kick on and they've got to have a plan and they've got to strengthen in the January transfer window as well. So we'll see, but it's great to see a club like Brentford up there, and the fans loved it.
Yeah, and I loved watching it, especially after backing them at 4-1. That always helps. Rob, thank you for joining us. I know they're sitting there. Michael's listening to this, and we do communicate with each other on a little WhatsApp chat as we're talking and doing the show remote. And he's just got nothing because he follows Arsenal, and you follow the mighty Foxes on the beat when you're not watching the Blue Noses. And
well, but Rob Tanner and I share a great love for the Blue Noses. So
yes.
You don't want to be taking me on, Rob Gilbert, because Rob Tanner's in my corner, brother.
Yeah, I expect that, but I also noticed that you've jumped off the bandwagon, and poor old Derek's probably just sitting there rolling his eyes thinking, I've got nothing.
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it, for Arsenal?
It is. It's devastating, mate. Hey, Rob, thanks for everything, mate. We've always been grateful for your time over all of the years. We hope there are plenty more opportunities to talk to you in the future. But thanks for joining us on our 300th milestone match to look at what hopefully is going to be a ripping season with fans back in. Just don't tell your editor that we said that.
Yeah. Congratulations as well on a great milestone. Great show.
Thanks, mate. Rob Tanner from The Athletic. All right, stick around. We're going to continue to talk Europe. Tanner's going to jump on the line. There's lots more to discuss after the break.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
for Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. Always love talking to our mate Rob Tanner before the break, but we never get through everything that's going on in the Premier League and Europe, and we've got a stack more to go. Derek, why don't you sort of guide us around the park, mate?
It was obviously a great weekend back, loads of goals, loads of action, barely a dull moment across those games. Manchester United 5, Leeds United 1. United rampant and Paul Pogba assisting 4 of those goals. Yeah. How impressed were you with United?
Yeah, Man United looked really good. I mean, especially, I think, when they went 1-0 up and then obviously they got a goal back. And you're thinking, oh, here we go. But then all of a sudden after that, it was just unbelievable football. And Man United looked really, really good. And we always know, like with Leeds, they're quite decent up front. But defending-wise, I think there's going to be a lot to be looked at. But I think outstanding performance considering the first game of the season. And you could pick loads of players, not just Pogba and that. There were just so many good performances.
Yeah, another good performance was Chelsea's 3-0 home win against Crystal Palace. Patrick Vieira, I think, will be disappointed with his first outing in the Premier League, but it was the ideal start for Premier League perspective champions Chelsea, and a dream goal for a young academy prospect, Chalobah.
Yeah, look, I think he's been there as a kid from the start. So and it was some strike, a super strike, about 25, 30 yards out. It's a great strike. So, yeah, look, he looks one definitely for the future.
Looking around some of the other games, as we said, they were all entertaining. I mean, plenty of goal action at Newcastle. A great start for Newcastle, but of course West Ham went on and won 4-2. Steve Bruce isn't going to have long, is he? The fans are back now. It's not entirely his fault, because apart from Joe Willock from Arsenal, the investment in the squad has been pretty limited. Do you foresee a pretty rough season ahead for Newcastle?
Yeah, I do. I mean, look, I thought Newcastle were good value in the first half. Then obviously it just all went away from them. But West Ham, I think, they've just carried on from last season. And they look really, really good. They had a lot of threats from all over the park. And I thought they defended well. I thought Newcastle were quite good value for quite long periods of the time. But I think their defending is always going to be the Achilles heel.
I tell you what, great result for Watford, 3-2 win over Aston Villa. And we spoke on the show last week about Villa being a dark horse for Europe this season, given their business. But it was the first time in a while that two teams won on the opening day of the season that had been promoted. A great win there for Watford. And Rafa, despite a terrible kind of start to his life at Everton, getting the goods done against against Southampton, that was a good result, Dino.
Yeah, look, he needed that, and that will settle, I think, a lot of people down. The first game of the season, if you can get a win, obviously that's vital. You've got 3 points on the board, and you can work on from that. But the one thing that's really stuck me, there was no draws, not one draw in the whole of all the games in the Premier League.
No, there wasn't. And again, I just think that impetus of teams coming back in front of fans in stadiums.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot to play for, and I don't think the early time of the season is not the time to be thinking about draws. So everyone was really going forward with their football. We've only not mentioned one, and we should mention it. Burnley 1, Brighton and Hove Albion 2. Poor old Burnley once again being left off my list, but good stuff from Brighton. Really nice start to the season for them. Looking ahead. Looking ahead to the games this weekend. Now, our bet of the week, we don't have a wagering partner, but if anyone in that entry wants to sponsor us, then please get in touch with us at Box to Box. But bet of the week last week was Arsenal losing to Brentford. Bet of the week this week is definitely, if he plays, Lukaku scoring against Arsenal. Arsenal versus Chelsea, it's just got that goal for him written all over it, I think, Dean.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, look, Arsenal... poor results in the first game, obviously, at Brentford. But Chelsea off to a start, and then all of a sudden you're adding him to the starting lineup. I think it could be a very interesting day for Arsenal.
just looking at that Arsenal defence, Ben White finding his feet, and Marie, I'm not sure about him. So I think Lukaku, if he gets a chance to run at that defence, he will be licking his lips. I quite like the look of West Ham versus Leicester City as well. Dino, what do you think of that game?
Yeah, look, I think that's got, again, Leicester off to a good start. West Ham, a good start. The only issue you might have, just might have, is that West Ham have obviously done quite well when we haven't had crowds. But obviously, you know, we know what West Ham and the stadium can get a bit raucous if it's not going their way. So I think it's going to be a really interesting game who comes out. I most probably think there might be a draw there, but who knows? I thought West Ham were really good value last weekend.
Just Liverpool will play Burnley at home amongst the title contenders. United are away at Southampton. Spurs, who beat City, are away at Wolves. And Manchester City have a slightly easier time of it, we think, at home against Norwich. So let's see. Let's go to the Championship quickly, Dino. Well, go on then. Tell us about Derby. They're on 4 points now and defying all the odds. And, you know, your friends at Forest are looking at all sorts of problems after their loss to Blackburn.
Well, they are. They've had three defeats. So, I mean, that's, you know, and I mean, Johnny B was on to me very early in round one and partly round two. And Derby, obviously, the week before had thrown away a 1-0 lead and then lost in, you know, injury time. So, I think it's a decent start. But, look, I still think there's a lot of work to do there. And for me, most probably the highlight for me out of the Championship is the Stoke City, how they've started. They look absolutely unbelievable at the moment.
Of course, with one of Australia's finest in the centre of defence there as well. So we will follow Stoke City this season. The top already looking like it has a bit of a familiar feel to it. West Brom does. Atop after they battered, let's say, Sheffield United 4-0 at the Hawthorn. Sheffield United already in the relegation zone. So we did say on this show we were wondering whether what the start would be like for Sheffield United and whether they'd struggle. Fulham are there. And also a bunch of other teams on 7 points, including QPR, who have started really brightly, Bournemouth, Stoke, as you said, and Blackburn Rovers, of course.
Yeah.
So interesting times, as always, in the Championship, Dino. Just moving on to Europe as we start wrapping up this this tight Euro segment. A few of the leagues are underway. The Spanish clubs are underway, and the big three all got wins, including Barcelona with their first win post-Messi over Sociedad, their president conceding that the team are in 1.35 billion euros of debt, describing the situation as, quote, very worrying. I don't think he's underestimating that there. And of course, in Germany, that's opened up too. Dortmund obviously lost to Bayern in the Super Cup, but made an impressive start with our friend Haaland scoring his 100th league goal for them. So, look, all happening in Europe, Rob. And, I just wanted to pull out Galatasaray's Markau, red-carded for headbutting and punching his own teammate. He ran half the pitch to do it and got sent to the stand. So, worrying for Galatasaray.
We don't talk about the Turkish top flight very often on the show. That was a good little introduction.
I want to interrupt. I have been to see a Fenerbahce Galatasaray match, and I've never been more scared in my life.
Well done, boys. Nice little tight segment there with Dino and Del, just having a fireside chat about football. All right, stick around. We're going to have a reflective stoppage time after the break. We're going to think of some of our favourite memories, our funny memories, and maybe just some observations and comments. Stick around for that next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, Talk Sport. The fourth official is Signals. There are 8 minutes left in our 300th episode. And there wouldn't have been even one episode if it hadn't been for our wonderful sponsors. So before I talk to the boys about their favourite memories, I want to talk to you about Storage King, the most award-winning successful storage company in this country. Yes, that is right. They have been nominated by Canstar Blue, the most satisfied customer award winner. Rated 5 stars for value for money, safety and security, quality of storage and convenience. They are Storage King. The great Michael Tate and David Scanlon started the business back in 1997 and they are going stronger than ever today. They are the kings of storage moving and more. Go to storageking.com.au to find your nearest store and give you back some space. All right, guys. Well, we need a little bit of space to talk about our favourite memories. Dina, I'm going to start off with you. I mean, there's one favourite memory that every time we have a milestone show that we always kick this off. And this one's about our friend Mark Van Aken, who was with us for probably the first 100 or so episodes. But it involves his incredible capacity to mimic voices.
He just had it down pat. And half the time, all you can hear me is laughing.
Which was your favourite voice? Was there one in particular? I mean, I know that that his goose hitting always had us in
this. Yeah, well, he was good at goose, wasn't he? He was very good at that, with that Dutch heritage.
Being a bit
as
Dutch
well.
Himself,
so, yeah, exactly. So a bit of Dutch heritage. So we'll give him that one. But, you know, I can't really choose a favourite, but Gus was always good because it was almost bang on, you know?
Yeah, and he just went from one to the next. And Dino, I'll flip over to Edge, and he might sort of comment on that one, because Edge was the maestro interviewer, and I was taking a break and I was listening to the show in a car park up in Sydney at Eastlands and just weeping from laughing. And Edge was just doing it so well to hold it together to ask the questions of all of the various guests.
Well, I remember Mark Van Aken had worked for me for probably 15 or 16 years prior to that. So there'd been plenty of times when Mark and I, in our, you know, day jobs, would be working together or travelling or doing something, and we would just be shooting the breeze. And that would be a regular conversation that I'd have with him, because his impersonations were brilliant. Every time I needed to be entertained or have a bit of a laugh, I'd say Harry Kuehl or Huss Hiddink. Or Ange Postecoglou. I loved his Ange Postecoglou. He was very good at that. And because he knew Ange so well, he had the mannerisms and the grumpiness down pat. So, it was a lot of fun. And we must try really hard to try and recover that interview, because it is the all-time greatest interview that we've done, isn't it, Dino? Fantastic. But Dino, you may not remember this, or you might, but I know Rob does, because he would remind me of this at least 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah, at least.
The night that I endeared myself to Josip Gombo, made him one of my closest and dearest friends.
Yeah. Well, what was the thing? There had been some controversy, and you asked him a question that he wasn't happy with.
Well, it was all to do with he shot through from Adelaide to join the Citigroup in New York, and that didn't work out, and he came back, and there was a bit of a slinging match behind the scenes. The previous owner of Adelaide United, Greg Griffin, who's no shrinking violet, he calls a spade a shovel. He'd been on the front foot within the Football Network, sort of potting Gombe. So I'd sort of just asked him about how his relationship with Greg Griffin was, and my recollection is, Rob, he didn't enjoy that question.
No, he didn't, and I was the peacemaker as always. There's going to be a controversial question.
It was legitimate question I asked him.
No, I don't know that it was. So what's happened is he's hung up in the middle of a pre-record. It had been organised by the Adelaide media manager. So we get off.
Well, he was working for the Socceroos at the time. So if you can remember, I think it was Ben O'Neill who did some very quick work behind the scenes.
And so I'm ringing up Ben saying, Ben, listen, mate, we're halfway through the interview. I promise you we're not going to refer to it again. Let's just get it back on. We'll edit the question out. We'll pretend it never happened, and we'll just get Josip on, and we'll just be all friends again. And he goes, mate, you promised me you won't do it. He said, I won't never live this down. And so we got him back on, and you could just tell that there was this sort of static electricity in the air, but we did the right thing by him. And Edge, as tempted as he was, I was sitting on the edge of a seat to see whether he'd ask the question again. Hang on, before we go, we haven't got all the time in the world. I've got to ask Willem.
No. I want to ask. We'll bring Willem in. Willem, do you remember when Rob called Trent Sainsbury turned Sainsbury about 8 times in an interview?
No, I don't. I think that was part of the Mark era as well, prior to me.
I think it might have been.
So it's typical of Edge to just exaggerate a little bit. So what had happened was Mark was a terrible typer, and we were talking about Swiss football teams and, you know, Grasshopper, etc. And he'd written out of context, turn Sainsbury, and I've just read it off the piece of paper, only to realise myself on the one and only occasion I did it, as opposed to the eight Edge.
No, you did it at least three times.
I'd done. So
it's your time to be honest.
That counts as my favourite memory. Before we get to Derek, Willem, what's yours?
Well, I don't so much have a favourite moment, Rob, but as we get to 300, I just thought I'd sort of reflect on the past year in particular. I think I came on board around episode 140, first in a writing capacity behind the scenes and then jumped on air. And just thinking back to how cushy those first 60 episodes were in at Media House there at 3OW, my first sort of foray into the sports media world, thinking, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And then over the past 100 episodes, just how, well, it's been a real crash course in sort of journalistic hustling, if you like. We've been the box-to-box wanderers. I remember we did episode 200 from Real Image Solutions, was it, Rob? Your friends
yes.
there?
Yes, yeah.
We've done shows at home, brand music, Damo's house, Damo's second house. We're back at home for episode 300. It's been a good last 100 episodes.
Yeah, Box to Box brought to you by COVID-19. It's been amazing. And to be fair, Willem, as the Cub reporter, the Jimmy Olsen of Box to Box, you've done incredibly well, come on a long, long way and crafted your career. It was always going to happen anyway, but it's been fun watching you grow and develop and grow your confidence along the way, mate. Well done. And well, I guess you're not the last arrival on deck. It was Derek Dyson, our former ITN journo turned pundit, who came in to visit the studio one day, and I just turned around and asked him a question. Is that your favourite memory, Derek?
Yes, I remember when you had winked me into joining this show, Rob. It was a total setup on your side, and I just had to think on my feet there, my first time behind the mic and in a radio studio. So thanks for that. And it wasn't long that it was episode 200, and I remember asking you and Edge, you know, the origins of the show, and I thought that was good content, the way you guys devised it over a beer or something like that. And it's amazing that it's come to 300, and hopefully a lot more. But from my point of view, for me, it's being on this show has allowed me to do something that I didn't think I would ever do, despite working in the media, which is chatting to some people who I have extremely high regard for, and I'm grateful to all of you who go out of your way to arrange these, whether it's Max Rushton, who of course is my all-time hero on the Guardian Football Weekly, Henry Winter, of course, from the Times, Martin Tyler, of course, the voice of football and my childhood as a fan. And yeah, so those for me have been the best moments for me. I love it when the team kind of gets together for a breaking story, when you guys have done your meeting on Monday and then have to chuck the whole agenda out the window. And I remember obviously the great Diego Maradona dying that week, and all the hustling as William said, to try and put together that show. And I thought that was, it's certainly the best show I've been involved in of my 100, just in terms of the guests and the pure quality of that output. But of course, my favourite stuff, of course, gents, is getting to know you all. But getting to know you all from a distance these days, I don't recall the last time I was stood in a room with you. So hopefully we can change that soon.
So, Rob, can I just...
I was just going to say, before you do, Edge, because like anyone who listens to this show knows that Edge's métier is to interrupt. I was just about to say, beautifully well said. So you can interrupt now, Michael. What were you going to say?
Well, I just wanted to... I'm quite surprised that Willem didn't mention that his highlight of the program was our Monday afternoon at 4:30, our phone hookup where we sort of do the production, because as it goes, the 30 minutes we spend on the phone, normally it's a 15-minute rant about the pandemic. We normally sort of bring in some international relations. We've had a bit of a discussion about Afghanistan this week, and then we spend 2 or 3 minutes on what's going to be on the show. So I'm surprised you didn't bring up that, Willem, because I know you sit on the end of the phone while Rob and I just sort of talk about the latest issues in world news, and we eventually get on to what are we going to do on the show.
As proud as I am of the show we put out each and every week, I think if we podcasted the Monday afternoon 4 o'clock chat, our ratings would go through the roof.
It'd be unplugged. Well, guys, you know what's going to go through the roof, because we're going to run out of time. It'll be the sponsorship dollars that we generate for this show from our friends at Chemist Warehouse and Storage King, because we'll be going into a third hour. So I'm going to have to wrap it up. Damien Tardio, thank you to you for your efforts and to other people who've worked on the show in the past. Nigel Slater, Pat Panetta have worked us for 300 episodes. We appreciate all the efforts that they put in. So Edge, Derek, Willem, Dino, Damo, excellent work. Let's get together another time next week and go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.